Welcome to the Lift Every Voice podcast, where we explore books by contemplative writers of color. I'm Christine Walters Paintner.
And I'm Claudia Love Meyer. We are joined each month by the author of our book club selection. Together, we explore how increasing our diversity of perspectives on contemplative practice can enrich our experience of the Christian mystical tradition.
We encourage you to join us by reading the book, listening to the conversations, and engaging with the reflection questions on our website at abbeyofthearts.com. Welcome, everybody, to our Lift Every Voice book club. I'm Christine Walters Paintner, and I'm joined by Claudia Love Meyer, my wonderful co-host and partner in all things book club conversation. And we're delighted today to welcome Aurelia Davila Pratt, who wrote this lovely book, A Brown Girl's Epiphany. I love the title and the cover. And it's from Broadleaf Books. And just to tell you a little bit about Aurelia, Aurelia earned her degrees from Baylor University and Truett Theological Seminary, an MSW and an MDiv, and she helped found the Peace of Christ Church, a sacred community in the heart of Central Texas, doing the work of radical love and disruptive peacemaking. It's a great description. And she has been the lead pastor there since 2018. And she's also the co-creator and co-host of the Nuance Tea podcast, along with Reverend Brittany Graves. And together, they're redefining what it means to be clergy women of color as they navigate discussions around healing, identity, and belonging. So we are really delighted to be discussing her book this month and to be featuring it in our book club. And welcome, Aurelia. It's wonderful to have you here.
Hi, thank you for the invitation. It's good to be with you.
Well, Aurelia, just to start us off, maybe if there's anything else that you wanted to say about yourself and your background that you felt was important and what led you to write this book, and then we can kind of break open things, from there.
Sure. Well, I call myself a sacred space maker. I think a lot of us are sacred space makers, and my particular context is a church right now. But what we do at Peace of Christ Church is create space for people who maybe have experienced dismantling of prior beliefs or shifted paradigms, or perhaps they've experienced a lot of church trauma and they're looking for a safe place to land. One of the things I've noticed, we started the church 10 years ago. I've been lead pastor for half of that time. I've noticed that a lot of people, they go through the deconstruction process. It's very liberating for them. And then suddenly they look around and there's nothing left. And sometimes they leave. They leave the church. They don't see the value in sacred community. Some people, it's right for them and what they need. But I really feel for people that kind of tear it all down and then never rebuild anything. I feel like for me, this book is kind of a combo of my own personal journey, situated in my particular experiences and identity, but it's also sort of this love letter to people who, are in that space of wanting to build something beautiful. I think there's still a beautiful faith to be had and there's hope, and so I think that's kind of what my book is trying to offer.
I love that. And I love that idea of the book as a love letter in particular. And our community, Abbey of the Arts, also draws a lot on people who are, disenfranchised from institutional church. And it's beautiful to have a gathering space for people who feel like they're on the margins and then to discover that they're not actually alone in what they believe. So absolutely. Thank you for that. Claudia Lipp, do you want to kick us off?
Yes, Aurelia, in the introduction, you spoke about claiming your brownness and how prior to
the election of the 45th United States president, I don't like saying his name, you didn't refer to yourself to others as a woman of color, and you hadn't really written or spoken publicly about your experiences as a brown girl. Could you tell us more about the before you did this and then after this vital integration of self and you know, living your brownness out loud?
Yeah, I think before there was this tamping down that I was doing, existing in predominantly white spaces, especially like from adolescence all the way up through adulthood. I had that knowing of how my identity shaped my way of being in the world or seeing the world or hearing perspectives from others who were sharing their truth. I had that instinct within me as well, but I think I was sort of unknowingly tamping it down because it so happens that my particular struggle, and we all have various struggles, but kind of my big one, it was always trusting myself. So I just always assumed any inner voice that was coming up that was different from what other people were saying was probably wrong. And so I did just a lot of tamping down, and it really helped me to see, you know, the people of color really being centered a little bit more than I had ever seen on the world stage and speaking out about their experiences. And I felt like I saw a lot more of that when He Who Shall Not Be Named was running. And it was like, oh, yes, I get this. But then to look around and see people who didn't get it and be really confused, but also realizing, you know, my experience was valid and it wasn't. I mean, I had always just kind of told myself like, oh, you're probably imagining that, or just kind of, I just was kind of isolated in that experience, particularly as a young adult. And so, yeah, that happened. And I remember I read Sue Monk Kidd's book, what's that book called of hers, that Dance of the Dissident Daughter. And I don't know if y'all have read that, but it really changed my life. And I think it changed a lot of women's lives. But for me, I remember I was reading it and with a group of women and everyone, and it was like, you know, white women in my context, and we were all having a lot of revelations. But I remember feeling like, as I was reading it, I remember feeling this difference between us. Like for them, it was this huge revelation. And for me, it was like, yeah. And one of my friends had said, you know, I feel like I'm finally understanding that I was existing in this like white boys club, and they had this revelation about it. And I was like, I just don't feel surprised right now. And I'm realizing it's because I was experiencing the white people club, trying to get into the white people club. And just the differences we experienced with that book. And of course it was a wonderful book and it was great. It was just, I experienced it different as a brown woman. And yeah, I just remember after that, it was just like this waking up, and I couldn't, it's not an option for me to go back to asleep to my own identity. It's like, so yeah, I don't know if that explains the before and after, but in my head, it's hard to keep it short when I think about all of that.
Well, I think it does. I mean, how could you go back? You would really have to talk about tamp down. You'd practically have to destroy your intuition.
Yeah.
To go on as if, you know, you weren't changed by that.
Thank you. Right. So of course I started preaching about it, talking about it, writing articles. I mean, it wasn't like, oh, now I'm suddenly writing about this concept. It's more just like, this is a part of like people, you know, my identity and people's identities are a part of these conversations that I was already kind of having. And especially when we're talking about justice or whatever, as people of faith, I always say you can't separate anti-racism work from your faith work. It's, you can't compartmentalize those things.
Yeah. Thank you for that. I want to have you develop this idea of intuition more, because you start off your book talking about intuition as holy resistance to those faith paradigms which do us harm, and embracing those which bring us wholeness and wellness, which is a really beautiful invitation. So how do we begin to trust this intuitive part of ourselves, and especially for those who have been so wounded and traumatized by the church? How do they learn to access this, you know, essential part of themselves?
Yeah, I think that people always, they always say, like, is it God or is it me? And I'm like, yes, you know, yes. And I think a lot of people are afraid of that because we've been taught our hearts are deceitful. We've been taught not to trust ourselves. And so it's, there's all these what ifs, like, well, if I let my, myself trust my intuition, well, what if I do the wrong thing, or I do bad things, or other people do the wrong thing or do bad things? And I just feel like we're not giving ourselves enough credit for the goodness that we are. And that most of the time we're going to make good decisions if we are listening to our intuition. And, you know, of course we have to keep in mind that we have egos and that we have the need for healing and good health. And, you know, of course we need community and guidance and support as we, you know, make decisions. But I think that, you know, our intuition is not really that different from when we talk about spirit within us. And spirit, you know, speaks to us, gives us nudges all the time. Our intuition speaks to us, gives us nudges all the time. It's not really a matter of if that's happening. It's more a matter of how practiced we are in listening and sifting out what's harmful from what's helpful when we make choices. So.
Yeah. I find that's a beautiful way to put it. And I find living in a culture that is so rational minded and so values, you know, logical thinking and planning and all of those kinds of things, that it can be a real challenge. And I often tell people, you know, how do I know I'm speaking to God? And I say, well, if you are finding that you're loving yourself more, loving the world more, you know, that's a pretty good indication that that's an encounter with the divine. And just, yeah, I think it's a gift to encourage people in that. So I'm grateful you're doing that work and wrote this book about it.
Right. And I'm not really speaking to people that don't need that message, you know, like, yeah. Most women or brown or Black women, or, you know, people of color or people on the margins are going to resonate with this idea of trusting yourself. Maybe the people who already trust themselves a great deal don't need this message. My earring fell out.
I put at the bottom of my questions that you're my wild earring twin.
Yes, I've got my heart since the beginning of February.
Dope. Okay. So how do you define intuition? What exactly is it?
You know, I think it's an inner wisdom and awareness that we have within us. An inner wisdom and awareness. And I actually, I talk about our stories and our intuition being connected. And I say, you know, we are disconnected from our stories, and that makes us disconnected from our intuition, and vice versa. And I think that if you think about our stories, whether it's the stories of our ancestors or our own experiences, those stories give us wisdom, and they give us awareness that we can move with better in our present and future moments. And so for me, that our stories are primers for cultivating our already existing intuition that's within us, but for cultivating that wisdom and awareness. And that's why those two things are so connected to me.
People of color, have so many traditions of storytelling, not just people of color, but I think because we are marginalized, and I'm speaking specifically of in America, because I don't, you know, have an international perspective, but, you know, because we're in the margins, we've had to kind of depend more on ourselves and our stories. And yet at the same time, you know, the larger culture and particularly evangelical Christianity, but I'm Catholic, so it's the same thing in fundamentalist Catholic churches. It's like they don't want you, even now, you know, they don't want you to trust your intuition. They don't want you to trust your stories.
Yeah.
They don't want you to trust the traditions that have sustained you and strengthened you, that have run contrary to what the larger culture was doing. What is this fear of allowing us to trust ourselves?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's this seminary term called the Wesleyan quadrilateral, or I don't know, maybe it's not a seminary term, but it was for me in seminary. And basically it's this concept that we have four main things that inform our faith. It's scripture, tradition, reason, and experience. And in my experience, I've seen three of the four uplifted. Scripture, you know, people like to kind of gaslight you with what the truth is there. Tradition, church tradition, which if we look at, you know, that and in our country, in the United States, what's the church tradition, you know, what's the dominant culture there within church tradition? And of course, reason, very like, you know, academia and all those things are kind of like almost keeping people on the margins, including people of color, but really everyone from accessing any value around their experience. But what happens when you do that, when you leave experience out, is that all these people with all these different theological lenses based on their very real experiences in whatever, you know, marginalized context they might exist in, have no way to contribute to what is kind of held up, what's lifted up, and what is considered truth. And there's no way to fold that in to a church tradition, you know, and so these voices get tamped out and these experiences get tamped out. And that's why when I say, you know, we have wisdom in our stories, when I think about, you know, my story as a like a Latina woman who had so much stolen, like my, you know, from me in terms of wisdom from my ancestors because of that disconnect and that forced assimilation and that border that got thrown up. And, you know, when I think about my grandmother's story and how much was lost because of that, you know, there's this tamping out of our stories, whether you think about Indigenous people and Indigenous wisdom, or of course the Black experience in America and all the generational trauma from the realities of slavery and how, you know, that has continued to impact people. But yet we're not supposed to remember those stories. We're not supposed to talk about them because in the present moment, they're not affecting anyone supposedly, but that's not true. So it's an act of resistance to reclaim your story, no matter who you are. But of course, especially in this context, we're talking about people of color.
Yeah, that's beautiful. I love that. And so kind of connected to that, I loved your chapter on stepping out of politeness and how politeness is this construct of whiteness that, you know, sets its own kind of boundaries and rigidity. And so what happens when we first buy into what politeness is supposed to look like? And then how do we break out of that kind of confine?
Yeah, I mean, I think that politeness is so often a band-aid, you know, it's medicine. It's not something that's going to heal us. Like, you know, it's like big pharma or something. Like, it's like, you want to stay sick and you want to just like spend enough to like feel a little bit better, just a little bit better, but you still need, you know, this system, this force. And so I feel like politeness is a band-aid. It's not actually allowing us to go into the deeper wound and really figure out how to find healing. And so I think for particularly people of color, because that's kind of the perspective I'm speaking from in this book, there's this kind of dominant culture, and it is the dominant culture in our country. It whether, no matter what, really what context you're in, the power and the sway has been determined in how we speak and what kind of manners that we use. And so often it's related to our faith. So scripture is used, and, you know, I talk about in my book about not wanting that to be used as a placeholder for actual work. Of course, it's wonderful to have manners. I have a 7-year-old. I'm teaching her about manners. But that's not enough. Like, and it's definitely not no good if it's keeping us from having real conversations or doing real peacemaking, because we're supposed to not rock the boat.
Yeah, I was going to say it's definitely used as a weapon, like a very subtle weapon. And a lot of times, I think in church contexts in particular, in that sense of, yeah, you know, don't raise your voice or don't, yeah, you don't want to rock the boat because, you know, we have to sort of behave in a certain way. And that shuts down those stories that you were telling us about.
Yes,
so,
yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because the story, a lot of churches want their diversity card. and I always, like, I'm in a predominantly white church and there are people of color, but I always say, like, this is the consequences, the reality of our roots. This is the reality of how we began, choices that were made in the beginning. Like, it's just the reality of it. And we have to be authentic as a community in how we engage those realities. But yeah, people want to have their token people of color in their community so that they can put it on their marketing and whatever. But what they don't really want are their stories. what my friend Bethany always would say, because we were in a seminary in this context, they want our smiles. Mm-hmm. You know, for the marketing, but they don't want to actually really hear what we really have to say, because if we do that, it will come across as impolite, even though it's just really like trying to be authentic and honest about what it means to exist in this space.
Yeah. Thank you for that. Yeah. Really powerful.
Chapter 5, you encourage flow and not force as the antidote to productivity culture. I love what you said about the home within ourselves as the ultimate safe place. Could you tell us more about what that inner home looks like for you personally and what it could look like for us?
Yeah, I got inspired with the home metaphor because I was listening a few years ago to an energy worker. Her name's Miriam Hasna, and she's amazing. And she talks about this concept of a home frequency being basically like the way I understood it is like this kind of home within yourself, where no matter what happens, or like say you were just totally good and you felt safe and you felt secure and you felt at ease and at peace, what is that? What that feeling within you, what kind of has to happen for you to maintain that sense of home no matter what's going on? And also differentiating from others, because sometimes we go into a room and we absorb whatever's going on in the room, or we interact with a person and we absorb whatever they're dealing with. And so she was saying, like, know your home frequency so that you can be like, no, I'm good. Like, I'm fine, even though this A, B, and C is going on. So I really was so impacted by those words. And I loved the metaphor of it in a spiritual sense of how in our spiritual practices and in our own inner work, can we create what we need within us to feel at home, no matter what's happening? And of course, we can't control you know, what happens in the world. We can't control loss or grief or things that come up, and it's easier said than done, but how can we sort of be grounded within ourselves as a practice, as a way to sustain us in the good and bad times?
Yeah. I like it.
Well, kind of going on that thread of kind of working against the productivity culture, you talk about how your community doesn't have a service once a month, and you encourage people to go do things that give them pure, uninhibited joy, which I just absolutely loved, particularly because I think that the church is such a proponent of doing, you know, in the service of trying to like see all the programs we're doing and all of that. Yeah. So tell us more how we step out of that productivity culture. And so what are the things that give you that pure uninhibited joy, and what kinds of things have you heard your community members doing? Like, what kind of gift does that give them?
Yeah. Well, I just want to say that first of all, this chapter was very difficult for me to write because I do feel like it's there's so much privilege that is involved with speaking about stepping out of productivity culture, speaking about rest. I do think that we can all probably do better at finding moments of rest, but it's really hard to talk about, especially for me as a person with a lot of privilege in terms of education, you know, financially stable. I work from home. I have so much privilege when I can think about how I can care for myself, that I just want to say up front, you know, mm-hmm. I realize this is a tricky conversation. One of the ways I try to think about it is by, you know, besides asking myself, how can I create moments of rest without comparing my context with anyone else's? Also, how can I create moments of rest for the collective? So when I look at the world, when I look at policies, when I vote, how can I be a person who's contributing to greater equity so that moments of rest are more accessible? And so in my community, in some ways, we're creating space for more rest for a whole collective of people, and also for ourselves, because as a small community, all pastors are multivocational. It's a big production for us to put on a service, and it expends a lot of resources that we don't always really have. So yeah, I think that everyone loves it. And I hear, you know, of people going on hikes or just sleeping in, especially people with young families. A lot of their children have their little sports and extracurriculars on Saturdays, and Sunday's their only day to really do nothing. And so it's such a gift to almost, for a lot of people, just not do a single thing.
Yes, I love days like that. And I hear you about the privilege. And I also love Tricia Hersey's work about rest as resistance.
Yes.
And,
yes.
You know, she really emphasizes how rest is our birthright and this, you know, profound gift. And if we don't claim those moments, we'll never have the resources to actually speak out and speak up. So thank you for encouraging that in your own way.
Yes. And she is, absolutely the person to go to and sit at the feet of and learn from. And because she's also speaking those uncomfortable for some truths about, you know, how, what it means to, I think she's really speaking to the Black people and really giving a gift to the Black community. And then the rest of us are just so lucky to be in proximity and learn as well. But the realities of, you know, how rest has been taken in so many ways, and also the generational connection for how that has, you know, come to be and how it's needed. So it's not just, you know, fluff.
yeah, exactly.
It's really thoughtful.
Yeah.
You wrote so many beautiful things in chapter 7 about dreaming. Why is it important for us to dream? That's also kind of a privileged feeling.
Yes, absolutely.
To be able to dream. I mean, if you're working 3 jobs, you don't have a lot of headspace to even dream.
Absolutely.
But it is important, you know, our dreams, like I have worked three jobs before and, you know, dreaming of a day when maybe I wouldn't have to. And so why are dreams important for us?
I think dreams are important because if we are not living in our authenticity, then we are not going to be able to sustain existing in these times. We need to be our authentic selves because it takes energy when we're not being authentic. And it gives us energy when we are being authentic. And I think that, you know, Imago Dei is literally to be rooted in our authenticity. And I don't think we can really find our way back to our authenticity without some dreaming, you know, without some like wishing and hoping and dreaming and carving out space for what could be when we're living in our authenticity.
I love that. Thank you.
I have a lot of negative associations with the word manifest or manifestation, largely because of white New Age teachers who kind of use it as a way to basically blame people who don't have, you know, material abundance for their poverty or for their struggles or whatever that is. But you had a very lovely and fresh take on it, at least for me, that made me soften a bit towards the word. So could you tell us a little bit more about your understanding of manifestation and abundance and how you envision that and how it fits in with this intuitive work? And
yes, I actually have a negative connotation of that word. And I think most people I encounter have a negative connotation or association with it. But I define it as the act of creating new realities for ourselves by changing our usual responses. And so, like I said, I actually don't use the word very often because, you know, it elicits a kind of a negative response from people. But like any buzzword, I want to actually explore it and be thoughtful about it. Instead of just tossing it out. And kind of what I came to was just that we can look at it as putting matters into our own hands and looking inward and making shifts. Because to me, when I think about manifesting, it's like getting something you really want. And maybe we don't get it. Maybe we don't receive it because I don't think we always know exactly what we want. But what if we just like made inner shifts within us, made changes to how we respond in conflict or like what we do when we're stressed out or how we proceed when we're not feeling confident? What if we just make shifts there? Like what happens when we consistently make those shifts? Do our relationships change? Do we grow in our craft or in our opportunities because we pushed through a little bit when we were not feeling confident and, you know, continued? So it's about making those disruptions in our own responses. We can't control everyone else, but we can control, you know, our inner posture.
Yeah, I love that image of the abundance being the way that we change our patterns and the way that we respond to the world in a way that's perhaps more compassionate and more life-giving and all of those beautiful gifts that we can offer to the world. Yeah. Thanks for that.
I always feel so seen when people are able to talk transparently about their mother wound, which you know. So thank you for the vulnerability and sharing that. I also have a mother wound. So it was really important for me to, even when I was a teenager, at one point I kind of walked away from the church. Maybe I was maybe 20, because I just felt like everything was so male-centered. So tell us about your journey to God the Mother and how that helped in your healing process.
Mm-hmm. Well, I do feel like my Catholic roots kind of helped more than if I would have been in kind of like evangelical spaces all the time, because I saw the reverence for holy women and particularly Mary in a way that felt really mystical and beautiful to me as a child. So I think that was sort of like deep in my subconscious, that openness to the divine feminine presence. But ultimately it was very difficult for me, like it is for many people, to engage with the divine feminine and that image of God. And I always tell people, yes, it's uncomfortable for you, but like in my experience, it was actually just truly comforting for me to experience God as male, because I had a mother wound and my dad was the presence that was there for me in those hard times. I felt more trusting and more comforted by a fatherly presence. So it actually, to me, is a testament to my insistence of how urgent and valuable it is that we look at Mother God and do the work within us to open up to her, because it really is that important, not just for me personally, so that, you know, I could experience my own healing there, but also for our society and for our little girls and all the things I say in my chapter about why it's so important to me. And I kind of like to say, you know, I'm not saying this lightly. It was not something fun or something I even wanted to explore because of my own trauma. But I really believe that we need that healing feminine imagery of God.
Christine, you've written a book about Mama Mary. What drew you to take on that subject?
It's called Birthing the Holy, and it's basically explores 31 names of Mary, different archetypes. And it came out last year. For me, I don't have a mother wound in terms of, I had a very good relationship with my mother. I definitely have a father wound, but my mother died when I was 33 and we were really close. So it was quite devastating to me emotionally in that sense. And Mary slowly became, you know, the way that I learned to kind of mother myself again and learn to reconnect to mother. And I love that there are so many faces of Mary. You know, there's, you know, the mirror of justice, and there's Mary as, you know, the fire that doesn't go out. And, you know, there's all these, Mary as Virgin, of course, being her kind of more traditional name, but even that means in sort of more Jungian sense, Virgin is about our wholeness, which of course you talk a lot about in your book in terms of returning to our wholeness. So the Virgin archetype is about how do we return to our own original wholeness and aren't under like the direction of anybody else. So I find all those different names powerful ways of entering into relationship with the sacred feminine from different perspectives, I should say.
So. Wow. I really want to look this up. I love Mary so much. She really was my entry point into that.
Yeah. And I'd say, like, growing up, I didn't have a really strong connection to Mary because she always looked so, you know, white and docile and in her blue dress. And, you know, there wasn't really something that I connected to. And then I found all these different manifestations of her in a different sense of manifestation of her in the world and in the kind of religious imagination. And I want to sort of connect to this because you talk about stepping into our child selves. And so I think that that's, you know, part of that healing from that mother wound is to come back to the gifts of of our child selves. And you talk about some of those gifts as being things like growth and acceptance and creativity and playfulness, which I loved. So how do we start to step back into our child selves, and how can we kind of encourage it to unfold?
I think we need to prioritize joy as a urgent spiritual practice. I think people want to experience joy once they feel they deserve it. And I think we need to prioritize giving ourselves access to moments and experiences of joy before we believe we deserve it as a spiritual practice. Because that is a part of our slowly coming to be kind to ourselves again. I don't know that we're just going to one day feel we deserve, or at least this is my perception, because I do access joy easily. It's like my superpower, and I just want everyone to like see that it's fine. And actually, I think you find more self-compassion and acceptance when you experience joy more, and it's okay to prioritize it. And also lightheartedness. We need to just be a little bit more lighthearted, not just with our joy practice, yes, but also in our deep learning, in our deep listening, and engaging some of these hard concepts and some of the things conversations we're having collectively. We can actually come to those with lightheartedness, and we can go easy on ourselves a lot better when we do that, because when we're lighthearted, it's not so heavy. It's not such a big deal that we admit if we're wrong, or that if we realize we need to change our opinion on something or change our beliefs, like it's not so hard. It's like, it's more playful and lighthearted. And I think we need a little bit more of that.
Yeah, I love that, because I feel like joy is another act of resistance to this productivity culture that, you know, that sort of just demands that we're constantly just working and producing, and not, and like joy is just taking pleasure in the moment. And I just think of the whole the trauma of the Puritan culture that, you know, the United States was founded on, and how I as a white person and my mother's ancestry all comes from that kind of Protestant work ethic, very Puritan. My grandmother like never had joy. And I actually sometimes try and practice joy and on her behalf, like as an offering to her, because I feel like she just was so steeped in this sense of like work, or, you know, never allow yourself any pleasure. So anyway, it speaks to my heart quite a bit. Yeah. Thank you.
I think bringing lightheartedness is especially in joy, is especially important as we do this work of naming the racism and the wounds, how they have affected us no matter what color we are. To bring lightheartedness to that kind of conversation, yes, as well, I think it's so important for us as we heal. Now I'm going to ask you about stepping into power. You wrote about your pink trauma. Sorry. After you wore dark colors not to stand out. I did something like that myself. For years, I only wore the color black. I didn't live in New York. But I think I was grieving maybe a life that I thought I would have, you know, maybe just that I had not tapped into my authenticity, and I wish that I had, but I did not know how at this point, how I would do it. And as a woman of color and a person who was naturally an artist, it was very difficult, you know, with a call to the ministry, and it was very difficult to figure out who I was, because this urge to create was so powerful in me, but so frowned upon in the Pentecostal church that I grew up in. And
at some point, I just wore black all the time. And you say, now wild earrings are an act of resistance against harmful messaging you received as a child. Now bold lip color heralds that healed and whole Aurelia is here to stay. And every shade of bright pink that you own lays claim to your power. You said you have seen the Imago Dei in yourself and you won't unsee her. And the more Imago Dei you see in yourself, the more you see in us. Can you talk to us about these really simple, but very authentic ways of owning who we are as a way of stepping into our power?
Yeah. I actually wore a bright pink blazer to my book launch party. And I forgot about the chat. Someone said to me, oh, you should read this paragraph at the party because look at you. And I was like, oh, I forgot I wrote that. But I just really believe in, quotidian and the little things are the big things, and our embodiment of Imago Dei sometimes comes before like our true belief in it. It's sort of this ritual. It's this symbol that, that we're gonna live what's on the inside on the outside. And that looks different for everyone. But I mean, for whatever reason, I just get my joy from those earrings and that lipstick. And I'm trying to prioritize joy. And I think, there's no one size fits all blueprint for that. But I'm just saying to whoever's listening or whoever's reading, what are you, what gives you joy? That's just the tiniest thing. And like, who cares what anyone thinks? Just go for it. It really is that simple. It is, the ordinary daily things that give us joy that we can do. I have this, I call it like the theology of the dish towel, because it's like the dish towel is something that we use every day. Like we wipe our hands on it or we wipe the counter on it, we have it out. And it's like, why not make that dish towel beautiful? Like go pick out a dish towel that you just smile every time you look at it. We have this practical thing, but we use it every day. So make it make you happy. And I kind of feel that way with all of our, the things we surround ourselves with, and just point to joy outside, inside, and I think we'll find, easier access to our Imago Dei that way.
Yes. And other people's as well.
Yeah.
What did you say?
I said other people's as well, because when we're living in that authentic space, in that home in ourselves, then it's easier to accept, what's his name? Harry Styles in a dress.
Yes.
I thought he was good in that dress. So
I know. Come on. Let people have their joy.
Well, Aurelia, it has been definitely a joy and a delight to talk with you about your wonderful book, A Brown Girl's Epiphany. We want everyone to buy a copy and think about it and reflect on it. So thank you so much for joining us. We so appreciate your time and your creative gifts and your obvious joy in life. So thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.